Okay, so that move to watching everything on your phone? Yeah, not so fast. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 21st day of October. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So, how do you raise almost $2 billion, $1.75 billion, and blow through it in something less than a year? I personally have no idea, but Jeffrey Katzenberg sure does. The Wall Street Journal reports this afternoon that Katzenberg, one of the founders of the much touted and once promising entertainment platform Quibi, for quick bites, real short bits of content, mobile first. Katzenberg is shutting it down. So for the second day in a row, Molly Wood is here with our lead story. Hey, Molly.
Hey. Hello again.
Hello again, yes. So what happened with Quibi?
Yeah, you know, Quibi, you have to give Jeffrey Katzenberg and CEO Meg Whitman credit. Quibi was consistent all along. This is a company that said, we are about mobile content. You are going to watch everything on your phone. We're about it being short, and we're about this specific technology that makes it cooler to watch on your phone. That's it. No compromises. And unfortunately, they had the double whammy of miscalculating, I think, how much people wanted to do that, and more importantly, how much they wanted to pay to do that, and arriving in the middle of a pandemic where all of a sudden people were at home with their big, huge screens instead of in the grocery store on their phones.
Right. Were you surprised? I mean, you and I have talked about this on Make Me Smart, but were you surprised? Because they had Katzenberg, they had Whitman, they had Janice Min at one point. I mean, this was a stacked cast here, as it were.
It really was. And yet it is one of those weird wisdom of the crowds thing where almost everybody was skeptical of Quibi. Almost everybody felt like, wow, that feels like a little too much money and a bet that is not entirely proven. What I'm surprised about is that after 6 months, Quibi is going to disappear. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't hear about that very often. They must have really not made a lot of friends in Hollywood to actually just go away.
Any lessons learned? Was it just an idea before its time and it's coming eventually, or, and let's hang out and wait for it, or what?
You know, I think the lesson is twofold. One, you cannot prescribe what people want to do in the way they want to consume. Like sometimes you really do have to follow a market. And also, content is king. You can't launch a streaming service without a library of content, a deep bench, and you can't be mediocre. I mean, the content, you know, the TV making landscape right now is operating at as high a level as it ever has.
Right. And a lot of the content reviews for what was on Quibi were meh, you know?
Right. Yeah. Some things were good, some things were terrible, some things were just okay, and that is not enough.
And $1.75 billion later, it is reportedly a done deal. Molly Wood, she's the host of Marketplace Tech, also with me, a podcast we do called Make Me Smart. Molly, thanks a lot.
See you later.
Yep, maybe tomorrow, who knows? on Wall Street today, well, they were a little glum. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. David Brancaccio has done a bunch of reporting on the Marketplace Morning Report about whether robots are or are not taking our jobs. You can listen for yourself. You should, by the way, to that show every weekday. But the World Economic Forum says, yeah, they probably are, a trend that's been accelerated by the pandemic. And business executives say the same thing in other surveys. And the deal is this: automation is disruptive in the very best of times. So what are we to do in times like these? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that one.
Robots have been taking people's jobs for a while now, for decades actually, but the pandemic is making that happen faster, according to Sadia Zahidi with the World Economic Forum.
It's sort of accelerated that process because of the forced digitization that has occurred for so much of the workforce.
Forced digitization, like the apps that restaurants had to start using to take orders, for example. But also just a mass rethinking of how business should get done. 67% of executives in a McKinsey survey say they are accelerating adoption of automation and artificial intelligence. Zahidi says a lot of employees see it coming.
workers are realizing that they need to take, to some extent, their fate into their own hands and do much more of that online learning and training.
One of those workers is Ryan Black, an actor in New York who's in a six-month boot camp to become a software developer.
Everything needs software these days.
It is 9 hours of class a day.
It is so tough. It is melting my brain.
Which raises a point, not everyone is going to be like Ryan Black and just become a software developer. What to do about them?
There are lots of important things we should be doing. First of all, we just have to make sure that people can continue to make ends meet.
Jared Bernstein is with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He is, for the record, not convinced that automation is sweeping the country any faster than it has been, but he says we should be prepared for it anyway. Susan Lund is with the McKinsey Global Institute.
One way to solve the problem today is going to be to create shorter training programs that are less than, say, getting a 2-year degree or 4-year degree.
On the other hand, she says the U.S. has lagged behind other countries when it comes to helping workers adapt to an economy that's changing beneath their feet. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Let us get transactional here for a minute. This pandemic has changed a whole lot of things, as we've been telling you, and among them, the way we shop. And now more than ever, if you can and are willing to pay people to do it for you and do it fast, retailers and shopping services are eager to assist. Marketplace's Erica Barris has that story.
For Paul Goldenberg of San Diego, it was at the height of stay-at-home orders in March when it started.
When everyone was going crazy over toilet paper and Lysol and all that stuff, I turned to Instacart.
The app connected him with a shopper that brought him what he wanted from an out-of-the-way Albertsons. Then there was this 96-degree day.
When my dog soiled some sheets on my bed, and I just knew that I was either going to have to get to the store with the whole heat thing and the mask and all that.
So it was back to Instacart for cleaning supplies and new sheets this time from Walmart. Goldenberg was already an online shopper. He bought lots of stuff from Amazon. But Instacart is different. The app launched as a way to get someone else to do your grocery shopping. Now it matches up gig workers with all kinds of same-day shopping errands. Instacart has added over 100 stores during the pandemic, including some that were all about the experience, like Sephora.
In certain cases, it's a connection to a brand.
Nick Shields is an analyst with Third Bridge. And right now, for stores that are struggling, like Bed Bath & Beyond, he says this is another way to stay relevant with customers.
They open the Instacart app to buy groceries, but also, you know, they'll buy some pillows and towels and things like that.
Of course, many stores already offered shipping. But because of Amazon, no one wants to wait. Carnegie Mellon marketing professor Jeff Gallick.
The logistics of doing something like same-day delivery for a relatively small outfit like Sephora, it's really hard for them to do that.
Especially at a time when lots of retailers don't have cash for that.
They don't have a choice, really. They have to partner with someone else. To build out that system for themselves, for every retailer to go out and do that, that's impossible.
So consumers are willing to pay, both a delivery charge and by providing a data drip. Because now Instacart knows what their weekly grocery list looks like, what their kids are wearing for Halloween, what over-the-counter meds they use. That means retailers have to share that precious shopper data. And it might be worth it to retailers, says Camilla Yanishevsky, an analyst with CFRA.
We think that the habits that were formed during COVID-19 cocooning will stick even after the pandemic subsides.
In San Diego, Paul Goldenberg continues to rely pretty heavily on Instacart's shoppers.
They're wearing their masks. They're going to the store. I'm not going in the store. They're bringing stuff to my door. I'm giving them a tip. It's a nice arrangement.
And he says it's probably an arrangement that'll stick. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
The governor of Puerto Rico relaxed some of the island's coronavirus restrictions last week. Slight bumps up in restaurant and theater capacities, among them. Did keep a 10 p.m. curfew in effect, though. For people trying to run businesses that depend on tourists coming to the island, the pandemic is just one of the many challenges they are facing. Maria Mercedes Grubb knows that all too well. She is the executive chef of a restaurant in San Juan called Gallo Negro. Chef, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
What was it like, just so people have some context here, what was it like running a restaurant in Puerto Rico before the pandemic?
Well, I mean, there's before Maria and after Hurricane Maria.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, the power grid in Puerto Rico hasn't been the best. So that forced us to many restaurants and many people in the metropolitan area to have to shut down sometimes during weekends, water outages. We're dealing with tourists trying to convince them to come back to the island, a very, very shaky political situation going on. And it just felt like every day was 2020 since 2017, really.
Yeah, I'm sure that's going to resonate with people because 2020 has been something. But so you're
exactly
So you're living that reality, and then actual 2020 hits and this pandemic, and then what happens?
Well, actually, before the pandemic, in January, we started having a lot of earthquakes, which also forced the power grid out and a lot of people to not be able to open. And this is January 2020. Then comes March. Puerto Rico immediately went into a lockdown, mainly because, you know, we're an island and we didn't really get the best support in the hurricane. So at least the government was smart enough to do a curfew, and it went from everybody had to be in by 5 to back to 7 to back to 10, back to 7 again. Huh. And just a fight against that COVID curve. But unfortunately, if you're a business owner, that means that you've been months and months without being able to open to the public or generate any money. And right. there's nobody helping you. So
tell me about that. Here you are trying to run a business. You've got people working for you, but nobody can come to the restaurant. I imagine you've had to lay people off and fundamentally close the restaurant, right?
Well, right before this happened, the numbers weren't really adding up. We kept trying to get backup from Maria, but like I said, every weekend something different would kind of like hit you back down, and eventually. My brother, who was the owner of the restaurant, Johnny, he sold the key.
Yeah.
But
he sold the key. What does that mean?
That means that we sold the space, everything inside the restaurant. A lot of business owners do this. So we got lucky in a way that we skipped the COVID. However, the plans to get up immediately, anything that you can think of getting back up is canceled because there's nothing to get up to. So immediately after this happened, I have a foundation that's run with a bunch of friends in the industry. And we just immediately took the task of feeding people in the industry and then to make money, a little bit of freelancing here and there, try to do pop-ups.
Yeah,
it's just a game of reinventing yourself and trying to find a way because people still want to eat. People still want to. Yeah. You've seen everybody's making banana bread at home. So everybody's trying to still stay relevant somehow.
I wonder if you're exhausted. You must be deeply, deeply tired.
You know, it's just even before 2020 hit, it just felt like it's been a game of you work twice as much to make half as much. And it has continued to be that way in the restaurant industry, unfortunately. And yeah, that's exhausting.
Chef Maria Mercedes, we got her in San Juan, Puerto Rico. You started on a restaurant called Gallo Negro.
Yes.
Now runs a foundation called Serve PR. Chef, thanks very much. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up.
Hey, everybody. Come revisit my material. It might have another life.
For free, no less. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials lost 97 points today, 0.3%, 28,210. The NASDAQ down 31 points, 0.2%, 11,484. The S&P 500 down 7 points, 0.2%. 34.45. Netflix down 6.9% today after missing those pesky Wall Street expectations for third quarter earnings and new subscribers. 2.2 million subscribers, new ones, just ain't enough, I guess. A survey by the National Retail Federation finds that shoppers plan to do less self-gifting this holiday season and to spend, this is a lot actually, it sounds like to me, $998 overall on gifts for others, decorations, and food. That is, as it happens, $50 less than last year. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Amy Scott has been working on a project about a single block in Baltimore, Maryland. A nonprofit group called Black Women Build is turning what had been mostly dilapidated housing and empty lots on Edding Street into a community of homeowners. The idea is to help Black women build construction skills and to help them build wealth through home ownership. It's also kind of an act of resistance against racism and disinvestment in those communities. But Black Women Build isn't the only group building on Edding Street, which is where Amy picks up the story.
When we last left Edding Street a few months ago, Quanche Henderson had recently moved into a small brick row house that she'd helped renovate as Black Women Build Baltimore's first homeowner. And back then, the block was still pretty deserted, with just a few occupied houses among the boarded up vacants and overgrown empty lots.
That part has been the most, I feel, challenging. Not having people who understand what we're trying to do, not being able to talk to people who kind of, like, have neighbors, really.
But neighbors are on the way. Just a few doors down, a generator hums as three women work on rehabbing the next cluster of houses they hope to buy through Black Women Build.
Hi, how are you?
Good. And Quanche is happy for the company.
As I'm seeing more work happening, I can feel the energy about the shift in the neighborhood. So I think it's a good thing overall.
But she's also troubled because at the end of the block, a massive housing development is under construction called Marshall Gardens. It's named for the late Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, who grew up in the neighborhood. Spanning several blocks, it'll be 87 townhouses and apartments, mostly subsidized for low-income renters. Many of those renters will be moved from an aging public housing project on the edge of a much more affluent and white neighborhood called Bolton Hill.
That's definitely a red flag to me. That is now being pushed over to this area. I just know what that means of why Marshall Gardens is being developed over here and not in Bolton Hill.
Over here is Upton Druid Heights, a predominantly Black community where the median income is $21,000. About half the units in the new development will be set aside for very low-income people with Section 8 vouchers. Most of the rest is so-called workforce housing, affordable for people earning somewhat more. Only 9 units will be market rate. Quanche grew up in public housing in a segregated neighborhood.
I already know what happens when you force a group of people to live in an area that does not have opportunities to advance.
Research has shown growing up in concentrated poverty can have disastrous health and social effects for children and make it harder to move out of poverty later in life. Proponents of the new project say it's a big improvement over the old one, which was built in the 1960s.
It's a garden-style fortress where it really is disconnected from the neighborhood. It looks like urban renewal housing for people with less means.
Jacqueline Alexander is vice president of real estate development for the Community Builders, the nonprofit developer building Marshall Gardens. On a recent afternoon, workers were framing the front steps on one of the new brick row houses. Inside, the walls are bright white. There are big windows and walk-in closets, and no way to tell which units are subsidized.
They all look the same. So there's no different finishes or amenities. You can't even tell the difference from the street. That's the whole point of it.
But it's still rental housing, most of it subsidized. And others in the community see Marshall Gardens as creating just another form of the segregation it's designed to replace. Kathleen Mitchell lives right across the street from one section of the development in a restored century-old row house.
We understand the need for low-income housing, but you need a healthy mix in order for people to have just access to more opportunities.
Her family's roots in West Baltimore go back 5 generations. Her great-grandmother, Lily Mae Carroll Jackson, and grandparents, Clarence and Juanita Mitchell, were prominent civil rights activists. Kathleen grew up a few miles away in a wealthy, mostly white neighborhood.
Actually, when my parents bought the house in the 70s, the Covenant still had no chickens, pigs, Jews, and Negroes.
Kathleen, who's 49, moved to Druid Heights 3 years ago to help revitalize the neighborhood. She's on the board of Black Women Build. She says Marshall Gardens is working against that progress. And this isn't about not wanting low-income people in the neighborhood.
You know, we're all low-income here. It's not that. Give the opportunity for homeownership. That's what we want.
But building new housing for sale or rent is expensive. And in low-income neighborhoods like Upton Druid Heights, developers say they can't make enough money to cover the costs. So they rely on subsidies that come with strings attached. In return for tax credits to help finance Marshall Gardens, most of the development must be set aside for lower-income renters for at least 40 years. City officials say it's the bigger picture that matters.
Marshall Gardens is one piece of a large puzzle that is coming to place within the community.
Alice Kennedy is Baltimore's acting housing commissioner. She says just a few blocks away is the state's first Black Arts and Entertainment District, with tax credits and other incentives for investment. Thurgood Marshall's once segregated primary school is getting a $6 million makeover as a community resource center and museum. Dozens of historic row houses are being rehabbed and will go on the market.
I think we're going to see catalytic change and transformation that respects the culture and traditions of those neighborhoods.
That's what Quanche Henderson is looking to do on her block. And when they arrive in a few months, she plans to welcome her new neighbors from Marshall Gardens.
And just knock on doors, let people know what resources are in the community, let people know what ideas we have. Maybe plan a cleanup once a month. And then that, I think, is how you start to form relationships.
And create a community of homeowners and renters that can come together for change. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Songwriter Tom Lehrer is 92 years old. He became famous back in the 1950s and 60s for satirizing just about everything. His work has been featured on stage in London and New York. It's been translated into Spanish and Swedish, been sampled on a rap track as well. And yesterday, Lehrer said everybody else can have at it, too, that he is effectively putting everything he ever wrote into the public domain. Lyrics, sheet music, all of it, free for anybody to use or perform, no royalties required. Marketplace's Justin Ho has that one.
Tom Lehrer's songs took on nuclear weapons, racial injustice, pollution, and the Nazi engineer turned NASA scientist Wernher von Braun.
Once the rockets are up, who cares where they come down? That's not my department, says Wernher von Braun.
Songwriters can earn money when websites post their lyrics, when people buy their sheet music, or when other musicians cover their songs. Abby North advises composers' estates. She says copyright holders usually are in no hurry to put their work into the public domain.
Because we all have families, and many of these copyrights have been sustaining multiple families for multiple generations.
Lehrer's giving up those royalties, but in exchange, he's trying to give his work a new lease on life, says Siva Vaidyanathan, a media studies professor at the University of Virginia.
Lehrer, in this case, is basically saying, hey, everybody, come revisit my material. Come do with it what you want.
The public domain inspired Disney characters Mickey Mouse and Mulan, and a lot of other great art, Vaidyanathan says.
So the works of Dickens, the works of Twain, the works of Shakespeare, the Bible, they all matter to us because they belong to us, and we can do our own versions of them.
That could mean we'll be hearing more of Tom Lehrer's work, says Jennifer Jenkins, who runs the Center for the Study of the Public Domain at Duke Law School.
There's empirical research showing that when material enters the public domain, it actually gets used more.
Lehrer's original lyrics and sheet music are available for download at his website. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, y'all know I love me some good beige book. The Fed's look at this economy region by region. Always lots of good anecdotal reporting in there. Restaurants aren't having a great time. There is, of course, the election. The word uncertainty appeared 20 times in this report. Here is the whole smash, though. The bottom line, this is a quote. Most districts continued reporting tight labor markets, attributing it to workers' health and childcare concerns. That's the end of the quote. Unemployment is at 7.9%, but labor markets are tight because the virus is in charge. All right, super quick moment of economic context as we go, courtesy of the Census Bureau's weekly Household Pulse survey, kind of related to that item from the Beige Book, actually. For the 2 weeks ended October 12th, 23.5% of American adults expect somebody in their household to lose employment income in the next 4 weeks. Think about that. Our media production team is Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, J.C. Bold, Charlton Thorpe, Ben Tolliday, and Becca Weinman. They're going into the studio every day so the rest of us don't have to, unless your home internet is terrible. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.